Chapter 8. Deck of a ship moored in Calcutta, I opened a letter telling me of the end of an enviable existence. He had made for himself a practice in some obscure little town of Austrian Galicia. And the letter went on to tell me how all the bereaved poor of the district, Christians and Jews alike, had mobbed the good doctor's coffin with sobs and lamentations at the very gate of the cemetery. How short his ears, and how clear his vision! What greater reward in ambition, honor, and conscience could he have hoped to win for himself when, on the top of the Furka Pass, he bade me look well to the end of my opening life? 3. The devouring in a dismal forest of a luckless Lithuanian dog by my granduncle Nicholas B. in company of two other military and famished scarecrows, symbolized, to my childish imagination, the whole horror of the retreat from Moscow, and the immorality of a conqueror's ambition. An extreme distaste for that objectionable episode has tinged the views I hold as to the character and achievements of Napoleon the Great. I need not say that these are unfavorable. It was morally reprehensible for that great captain to induce a simple-minded Polish gentleman to eat dog by raising in his breast a false hope of national independence. It has been the fate of that credulous nation to starve for upward of 100 years on a diet of false hopes and well dog. It is, when one thinks of it, a singularly poisonous regimen. Some pride in the national constitution which has survived a long course of such dishes is really excusable. But enough of generalizing. Returning to particulars, Mr. Nicholas B. confided to his sister-in-law, my grandmother, in his misanthropically laconic manner, that this supper in the woods had been nearly the death of him. This is not surprising. What surprises me is that the story was ever heard of. For Granduncle Nicholas differed in this from the generality of military men of Napoleon's time and perhaps of all time, that he did not like to talk of his campaigns, which began at Friedland and ended somewhere in the neighborhood of Bar-le-Duc. His admiration of the great emperor was unreserved in everything but expression. Like the religion of earnest men, it was too profound a sentiment to be displayed before a world of little faith. Apart from that, he seemed as completely devoid of military anecdotes as though he had hardly ever seen a soldier in his life. Proud of his decorations earned before he was 25, he refused to wear the ribbons at the buttonhole in the manner practiced to this day in Europe, and even was unwilling to display the insignia on festive occasions, as though he wished to conceal them in the fear of appearing boastful. "It is enough that I have them," he used to mutter. In the course of 30 years they were seen on his breast only twice at an auspicious marriage in the family, and at the funeral of an old friend. That the wedding which was thus honored was not the wedding of my mother I learned only late in life, too late to bear a grudge against Mr. Nicholas B., who made amends at my birth by a long letter of congratulation containing the following prophecy: "He will see better times." Even in his embittered heart there lived a hope. But he was not a true prophet. He was a man of strange contradictions. Living for many years in his brother's house, the home of many children, a house full of life, of animation, noisy with a constant coming and going of many guests, he kept his habits of solitude and silence. Considered as obstinately secretive in all his purposes, he was in reality the victim of a most painful irresolution in all matters of civil life. Under his taciturn, phlegmatic behavior was hidden a faculty of short-lived passionate anger. I suspect he had no talent for narrative, but it seemed to afford him somber satisfaction to declare that he was the last man to ride over the bridge of the River Elster after the Battle of Leipzig. Lest some construction favorable to his valor should be put on the fact, he condescended to explain how it came to pass. It seems that shortly after the retreat began he was sent back to the town, where some divisions of the French army, and among them the Polish corps of Prince Joseph Poniatowski, jammed hopelessly in the streets, were being simply exterminated by the troops of the Allied powers. When asked what it was like in there, Mr. Nicholas B. muttered only the word, "Ambles." Having delivered his message to the prince, he hastened away at once to render an account of his mission to the superior who had sent him. By that time the advance of the enemy had enveloped the town, and he was shot at from houses, and chased all the way to the river bank by a disorderly mob of Austrian dragoons and Prussian hussars. The bridge had been mined early in the morning, and his opinion was that the sight of the horsemen converging from many sides, in the pursuit of his person, alarmed the officer in command of the sappers, and caused the premature firing of the charges. He had not gone more than 200 yards on the other side, when he heard the sound of the fatal explosions. Mr. Nicholas B. concluded his bald narrative with the word, "Vessel," uttered with the utmost deliberation. It testified to his indignation at the loss of so many thousands of lives. But his phlegmatic physiognomy lighted up when he spoke of his only wound, with something resembling satisfaction. You will see that there was some reason for it when you learn that he was wounded in the heel. Ike His Majesty the Emperor Napoleon himself, he reminded his hearers, with assumed indifference. There can be no doubt that the indifference was assumed, if one thinks what a very distinguished sort of wound it was. In all the history of warfare there are, I believe, only three warriors publicly known to have been wounded in the heel: Achilles and Napoleon, demigods indeed to whom the familial piety of an unworthy descendant adds the name of the simple mortal, Nicholas B. The 100 days found Mr. Nicholas B. staying with a distant relative of ours, owner of a small estate in Galicia. How he got there across the breadth of an armed Europe, and after what adventures, I am afraid will never be known now. All his papers were destroyed shortly before his death, but if there was among them, as he affirmed, a concise record of his life, then I am pretty sure it did not take up more than a half sheet of foolscap or so. This relative of ours happened to be an Austrian officer who had left the service after the Battle of Austerlitz. Unlike Mr. Nicholas B., who concealed his decorations, he liked to display his honorable discharge, in which he was mentioned as unshreckbar, fearless, before the enemy. No conjunction could seem more unpromising, yet it stands in the family tradition that these two got on very well together in their rural solitude. When asked whether he had not been sorely tempted during the 100 days, to make his way again to France, and join the service of his beloved emperor, Mr. Nicholas B. used to mutter, "No money. No horse. Too far to walk." The fall of Napoleon and the ruin of national hopes affected adversely the character of Mr. Nicholas B. He shrank from returning to his province. But for that there was also another reason. Mr. Nicholas B. and his brother, my maternal grandfather, had lost their father early, while they were quite children. Their mother, young still and left very well off, married again a man of great charm, and of an amiable disposition, but without a penny. He turned out an affectionate and careful stepfather. It was unfortunate, though, that while directing the boy's education, and forming their character by wise counsel, he did his best to get hold of the fortune, by buying and selling land in his own name and investing capital in such a manner as to cover up the traces of the real ownership. It seems that such practices can be successful, if one is charming enough to dazzle one's own wife permanently, and brave enough to defy the vain terrors of public opinion. The critical time came when the elder of the boys, on attaining his majority, in the year 1811, asked for the accounts, and some part at least of the inheritance to begin life upon. It was then that the stepfather declared with calm finality that there were no accounts to render, and no property to inherit. The whole fortune was his very own. He was very good-natured about the young man's misapprehension of the true state of affairs, but, of course, felt obliged to maintain his position firmly. Old friends came and went busily, voluntary mediators appeared traveling on most horrible roads from the most distant corners of the three provinces, and the marshal of the nobility, ex officio guardian of all well-born orphans, called a meeting of landowners, to ascertain in a friendly way how the misunderstanding between Ten and his stepsons had arisen, and devise proper measures to remove the same. A deputation to that effect visited X, who treated them to excellent wines, but absolutely refused his ear to their remonstrances. As to the proposals for arbitration, he simply laughed at them. Yet the whole province must have been aware that 14 years before, when he married the widow, all his visible fortune consisted, apart from his social qualities, in a smart 4-horse turnout with 2 servants, with whom he went about visiting from house to house. And as to any funds he might have possessed at that time, their existence could only be inferred from the fact that he was very punctual in settling his modest losses at cards. But by the magic power of stubborn and constant assertion, there were found presently, here and there, people who mumbled that surely here must be something in it. However, on his next name day, which he used to celebrate by a great 3 days shooting party, of all the invited crowd only 2 guests turned up, distant neighbors of no importance. One notoriously a fool, and the other a very pious and honest person, but such a passionate lover of the gun, that on his own confession he could not have refused an invitation to a shooting party from the devil himself. 10. Met this manifestation of public opinion with the serenity of an unstained conscience. He refused to be crushed. Yet he must have been a man of deep feeling, because, when his wife took openly the part of her children, he lost his beautiful tranquility, proclaimed himself heartbroken, and drove her out of the house, neglecting in his grief to give her enough time to pack her trunks. This was the beginning of a lawsuit, an abominable marvel of chicken, which by the use of every legal subterfuge, was made to last for many years. It was also the occasion for a display of much kindness and sympathy. All the neighboring houses flew open for the reception of the homeless. Neither legal aid nor material assistance in the prosecution of the suit was ever wanting. X, on his side, went about shedding tears publicly over his stepchildren's ingratitude and his wife's blind infatuation. But as at the same time he displayed great cleverness in the art of concealing material documents, he was even suspected of having burned a lot of historically interesting family papers. This scandalous litigation had to be ended by a compromise lest worse should befall. It was settled finally by a surrender, out of the disputed estate, in full satisfaction of all claims, of 2 villages with the names, of which I do not intend to trouble my readers. After this lame and impotent conclusion, neither the wife nor the stepsons had anything to say to the man who had presented the world with such a successful example of self-help based on character, determination, and industry. And my great-grandmother, her health completely broken down, died a couple of years later in Carlsbad. Legally secured by a decree in the possession of his plunder, Ten regained his wonted serenity, and went on living in the neighborhood in a comfortable style and in apparent peace of mind. His big shoots were fairly well attended again. He was never tired of assuring people that he bore no grudge for what was past. He protested loudly of his constant affection for his wife and stepchildren. It was true, he said, that they had tried to strip him as naked as a Turkish saint in the decline of his days, and because he had defended himself from spoliation, as anybody else in his place would have done, they had abandoned him now to the horrors of a solitary old age. Nevertheless, his love for them survived these cruel blows. And there might have been some truth in his protestations. Very soon he began to make overtures of friendship to his eldest stepson, my maternal grandfather, and when these were peremptorily rejected he went on renewing them again and again with characteristic obstinacy. For years he persisted in his efforts at reconciliation, promising my grandfather to execute a will in his favor, if he only would be friends again to the extent of calling now and then. It was fairly close neighborhood for these parts, 40 miles or so, or even of putting in an appearance for the great shoot on the name day. My grandfather was an ardent lover of every sport. His temperament was as free from hardness and animosity as could be imagined. Pupil of the liberal-minded Benedictines who directed the only public school of some standing then in the South, he had also read deeply the authors of the 18th century. In him, Christian charity was joined to a philosophical indulgence for the failings of human nature. But the memory of those miserably anxious early years, his young man's ears robbed of all generous illusions by the cynicism of the sordid lawsuit, stood in the way of forgiveness. He never succumbed to the fascination of the great shoot, and his heart set to the last on reconciliation, with the draft of the will ready for signature kept by his bedside, died intestate. The fortune thus acquired, and augmented by a wise and careful management, passed to some distant relatives whom he had never seen, and who even did not bear his name. Meantime, the blessing of general peace descended upon Europe. Mr. Nicholas B., bidding goodbye to his hospitable relative, the earless Austrian officer, departed from Galicia, and without going near his native place, where the odious lawsuit was still going on, proceeded straight to Warsaw, and entered the army of the newly constituted Polish kingdom under the scepter of Alexander I, autocrat of all the Russias. This kingdom, created by the Vienna Congress as an acknowledgement to a nation of its former independent existence, included only the central provinces of the old Polish patrimony. A brother of the emperor, the Grand Duke Konstantin Pavlovich, its viceroy and commander-in-chief, married morganatically to a Polish lady to whom he was fiercely attached, extended this affection to what he called "white Poles" in a capricious and savage manner. Sallow in complexion, with a Tartar physiognomy and fierce little eyes, he walked with his fists clenched, his body bent forward, darting suspicious glances from under an enormous cocked hat. His intelligence was limited, and his sanity itself was doubtful. The hereditary taint expressed itself, in his case, not by mystic leanings as in his two brothers, Alexander and Nicholas, in their various ways, for one was mystically liberal and the other mystically autocratic, but by the fury of an uncontrollable temper which generally broke out in disgusting abuse on the parade ground. He was a passionate militarist and an amazing drill master. He treated his Polish army as a spoiled child treats a favorite toy, except that he did not take it to bed with him at night. It was not small enough for that. But he played with it all day and every day, delighting in the variety of pretty uniforms and in the fun of incessant drilling. This childish passion, not for war, but for mere militarism, achieved a desirable result. The Polish army, in its equipment, in its armament, and in its battlefield efficiency, as then understood, became, by the end of the year 1830, a first-rate tactical instrument. Polish peasantry, not serfs, served in the ranks by enlistment, and the officers belonged mainly to the smaller nobility. Mr. Nicholas B., with his Napoleonic record, had no difficulty in obtaining a lieutenancy, but the promotion in the Polish army was slow, because, being a separate organization, it took no part in the wars of the Russian Empire against either Persia or Turkey. Its first campaign, against Russia itself, was to be its last. In 1831, on the outbreak of the revolution, Mr. Nicholas B. was the senior captain of his regiment. Some time before, he had been made head of the renowned establishment quartered outside the kingdom in our southern provinces, whence almost all the horses for the Polish cavalry were drawn. For the first time, since he went away from home at the age of 18, to begin his military life by the Battle of Friedland, Mr. Nicholas B. breathed the air of the order, his native air. Unkind fate was lying in wait for him among the scenes of his youth. At the first news of the rising in Warsaw, all the renowned establishment, officers, vets, and the very troopers, were put promptly under arrest and hurried off in a body beyond the Dnieper to the nearest town in Russia proper. From there they were dispersed to the distant parts of the empire. On this occasion, poor Mr. Nicholas B. penetrated into Russia much farther than he ever did. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.